when he wore, when Jesus wore, he washed my sins away.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lots to talk about on how we can slow down the aging process, how we can help prevent cardiovascular problems, and also how we can live a longer life. And we try to bring you always the best cutting-edge material from mainstream peer-reviewed journals. And that's the irony. For a long time, people thought that anything that was really meaningful as far as healthy living came from some abstract notion, something out there, something that is not scientifically based. And what we do is show that virtually all the major positive changes to living a longer and healthier life have already been verified and proven in mainstream science. It's just not disseminated. There's just too much conflict there. After all, if you talked about processed meats causing cancer, and there are at least four separate studies over the last 5 years showing that, especially colorectal cancer, what are you going to do with that if you're the Surgeon General or the U.S. Public Health Service, knowing full well that some of the largest political contributions come from the fast food giants, the people who use more processed meats than anyone else? And the moment you start to put that information up, they're going to say, pull it back. And that's the reality of today. So I'm going to give you the latest on health and healing. And then from our environmental segment, we're going to take a look at, without plants, Earth would cook under billions of tons of additional carbon. I'm also going to talk from our public health segment today about how the government's vaccine policy is infected by corruption, by Dr. Robert Murdoch. My guest in the second part of our program today is going to talk about the latest true information about Syria. And this is going to be interesting because this is Professor Paul Piller. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in the Security Intelligence Division and the Foreign Service Department at Georgetown University. By the way, he served for 28 years in the CIA. And in fact, he was the deputy chief of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. And so he has some unique insights, and he'll tell us the truth on that. A commentary today about what America has become. I know I'm concerned. I know you're concerned, because every day we see it changing, and we see it changing so rapidly. A special commentary from Countercurrents, John Chuckman. Also today, if time permits, a nation brought to the verge of ruin. And we'll take a look at that as well. Let's begin. Quercetin, Q-U-E-R, cetin, C-E-T-I-N, you find when you eat onions or apples or grapes. It's a terrific nutrient. And in fact, I remember being at the Linus Pauling Institute in California, and a Dr. Jawala, who was the chief virology scientist, showed me that when he added quercetin to dishes that were supposed to have contained the HIV virus, that it killed all of them. And he would already had published an article on this. And I thought, wow, well, that's a very powerful nutrient. Yes, it is. This is from the latest research on it. Quercetin protects against cadmium-induced oxidative toxicity. Now, keep in mind that it's an antioxidant. Antioxidants grab onto or attach to free radicals, and that neutralizes them. But also, it has the capacity to counter the toxic effects of cadmium on the body. This was published in a peer-reviewed journal on the autonomy of the body, the anatomy, and done at Xinjiang University in China. Quote, cadmium is a highly dangerous and widespread heavy metal that has been linked to cancer, impaired brain function, and development and damage to organs, including the lungs, kidneys, and bones. According to a groundbreaking study at Arizona State University, researchers that published in the Journal of Biological Trace Element Research earlier this year, high blood levels of cadmium are one of the single strongest factors linked to the severity of autism symptoms. The Center for Disease Control lists cadmium as number 7 among the 275 most hazardous substances. Now, here's where it gets interesting, and I'll just put this in lay language. In this Chinese study, they took just cadmium, and they found at what level does it cause damage. It doesn't take much, by the way. And what happens when you introduce different antioxidants to it? And they found that the one antioxidant that made a substantial difference was quercetin. So imagine then that you're having apple juice with celery and cucumber to detoxify. The quercetin that is plentiful in apples, it's in the flavonoid family. Also teas, green tea, and red wine also has it. That can help negate damage from smoking, because one of the byproducts of smoking is cadmium. One of the byproducts of living in a polluted city is cadmium. And we have a lot of pollution in the air that we just don't see. In some cities, yeah, you fly into Phoenix, boy, you see it. You see a whole smog over the whole area. Los Angeles, also. Mexico City, wow, you have to fly into Mexico City to see how bad it actually is. I would say taking 2,000 milligrams a day in divided doses, meaning 500 milligrams four times a day, that can help protect you from heavy metal toxic reactions. And it also means that you should be giving your children quercetin because it could help them with preventing autism. And there was another research done on quercetin by the Institute of Food Research, published in the peer-reviewed journal Atherosclerosis, and showed that quercetin was extremely important in helping the body detoxify. So that's good. Now, another thing that's good that we don't eat very much is alfalfa. Mainly horses eat alfalfa. But alfalfa sprouts are extremely important because they contain a nutrient called saponin. SAP, S-A-P-O-N-I-N, O-N-I-N. This research shows it can prevent heart disease. And here is what it says. By the way, the whole idea of alfalfa was not for human consumption. Mainly alfalfa was cultivated for over 3,000 years, and it was given to animals because it was so rich. Yes, humans could eat alfalfa. It is loaded with phytonutrients, carotene, chlorophyll, cumarins, isoflavones, alkaloids, saponins. All of these are chemicals. And you have to understand, in the average, let's say the average food, broccoli or an apple, garlic, you probably have between 75 to 300 different chemicals. And they're all important in our body. The way that alfalfa was shown to prevent and reduce the development of atherosclerosis, which is epidemic in the United States, it was simply consuming it on a regular basis. It can lower your bad cholesterol. And it was published in the Pakistan Journal of Pharmaceutical Sciences. So that's good. And then researchers at the University of Toronto studied and discovered a few ways how alfalfa saponins can help inhibit cancer cells. And it works this way, in just lay language. The saponins seem to bind to cancer cells and therefore limit their movement. And then intestinal bacteria can convert bile into a carcinogenic substance, which can eventually lead to colon cancer. But by binding with the bile, the saponins also prevent such conversion to occur. And last, saponins were also capable of getting rid of intestinal pathogens, which would generally cause inflammation. So, all good about making sure that you get your alfalfa sprouts in. I remember when I had a private conversation with the director of the National Cancer Institute. I had written several really harsh articles. In fact, they were the first primary nationally published articles on the politics of cancer in the United States history. And I had been given a tip as early as 1974. I wrote the articles in 1975, my first with Robert Houston. And no one wanted to believe the information, even if it was fully documented, because it was taking on a sacred cow, the cancer industry. I can't tell you how many people were angry because they said, the cancer industry, they're not going to play with people's lives. I mean, this is serious stuff. Other areas, yes, but not cancer. But in fact, it was even worse in the cancer industry. And so it led to about 13 separate articles. And then that opened it up to a whole piece on 2020 and another piece on 60 Minutes. And then the whole thing came just bursting open. The politics, the self-interest, the double-dealing, everything about cancer then was open to being challenged. And then after a period of time, that door closed again. And then all that was bad became good again. And that all that was corrupt became a positive again. It's just amazing how quickly we forget that the people didn't change, the industries didn't change, their practices didn't change. It's just time changed and we went on to other things and forgot. Well, we shouldn't. Here is the latest reason why you should pay attention. And when I was in this conversation with the director of the National Cancer Institute, I said, one of your own founders, a man named Dr. Dean Burke, says that fluoride is responsible for upwards of 15,000 cancer deaths per year, and he has all the documentation. But others say that you're not putting money into real prevention. I remember he saying, I can only do what is possible, meaning read through that. He is limited. And so we have to understand that the institutions that control the whole cancer machine, you see all these people wearing the pink ribbons out there, fine. If you want to prevent breast cancer in women, and we all do, or should, then let's talk about preventing breast cancer. Let's get rid of all the alcohol and coffee and all the processed foods and the stress. That's what causes the cancer, not some form of gene that has gone crazy. But you won't see that. Instead, put your money into marching or biking or auctioning or something that, or football players at every game now wearing the pink. They won't prevent one single case of breast cancer, and they won't help one single person who has it because they're using the flawed model. This is from Natural News. Quote, chemotherapy actually increases cancer growth, cancer cells becoming resistant to treatment, new study. The cancer treatment scam that is chemotherapy has once again been shown in the scientific literature to be a major cause rather than a cure for cancer. According to a new study recently published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature, and by the way, for those who are not aware of it, Nature is considered the foremost scientific journal in the world. Of all the journals in the world, it would be number one. Chemotherapy not only promotes the growth and spread of cancer cells by damaging the healthy tissue that surrounds tumors, but it also causes cancer cells to develop full-on resistance to the popular treatment, morphing them into super cancer cells. Researchers from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington, learned this after observing the effects of chemotherapy on healthy cell tissue. What they found is something that we were aware of. I've certainly been aware of this for decades because I had a person who was in the peer review system, a major player in the war on cancer, who told me this. And but the medical system as a whole is only just now waking up. Chemotherapy, which is a recognized poison, damages the DNA of healthy, non-cancerous cells, causing them to produce molecules that turn into more cancer cells. Now, it doesn't take a scientist to make this deduction. Of course, a simple common sense dictates that blasting healthy cells along with unhealthy cells is going to cause damage to all the cells. I once said in 1975 on a radio program, and I was told this figure by Dr. Dean Burke of the National Cancer Institute, one of its founders, that for every cancer cell you kill with chemotherapy, you will kill 1,000 healthy cells. So their logic is simple. Let's kill as many cancer cells as possible before we kill the body, the host. Sometimes it works. More often than not, it does not. But this is apparently big news up in the Northwest, where scientists are apparently baffled as to how this can be. And we're now talking about minor damage here. No, we're talking about major damage to healthy cells. It occurs as a result of routine chemotherapy treatments. Quote, the researchers found the chemotherapy can cause fibroblast cell DNA to increase production of a molecule called WNT16b by 3,000% in tissue surrounding a tumor, end quote. That's from their study. That explains the group Cancer Research UK in a recent report on a study, quote, this then helps cancer cells to grow, invade neighboring cells, and resist chemotherapy, end quote. Now, what do I mean by a super cancer cell caused by chemotherapy more deadly than ever? So this is not bad enough. The same team found that another major side effect of chemotherapy is cancer cells grow more virulent than they were before the treatment, like superbugs and superweeds, which we now acknowledge are resistant in response to conventional drug therapy and chemical sprays, respectively. These super cancer cells no longer respond even to the most aggressive forms of chemotherapy, which means cancer itself is becoming more deadly. Quote, these results delineate a mechanisms by which genotoxic therapies given in a cyclical manner can enhance subsequent treatment resistance through cell non-autonomous effects that are contributed by the tumor microenvironment, end quote. So there you have it. Did you read about this? Did you hear it? Was Dr. Gupta and others railing then against chemotherapy? Not at all. But the science is there. Done in a very prestigious institute, published in the most respected scientific journal in the world, and confirmed by other studies. This is not the only study showing that chemotherapy is a cancer-causing agent. So just be aware that when you go in and you're told about how good all this is, it's all subjective. From our environmental segment today, I'm very concerned, as I know many of you are, about global warming. I'm doing a major documentary on this subject as we speak and have been for some time. This is the latest information because sometimes you can act like the frog in water that's being boiled, but it's slow, and by the time it's too late and you're boiled, you have adapted to it. You adapt to death, and that's what we've done. We always assume that someone is out there fighting on our behalf. Someone's going to wake up in the Congress, someone at the EPA, someone in the White House. The fact is, that's not true. Nothing is being done. When I say nothing, I mean zip, nothing to stop global warming. Nothing. And it won't. It can't. And we understand why. And if you listen to MSNBC and you listen to Fox, they're virtually the same. They just take different sides of an argument, but the arguments are the same. All the things they could discuss that are meaningful, they don't. And all they do is blame the other for our problems, as if that's the solution. It isn't. And neither have come out and campaigned actively and put themselves on the line. Here's the latest from Morgan Kelly. Quote, without plants, the Earth would cook under billions of tons of additional carbon. Enhanced growth of Earth's leafy greens during the 20th century has significantly slowed the planet's transition to being red hot. That's according to the first study to specify the extent to which plants have prevented climate change since pre-industrial times. Researchers based at Princeton University found that land ecosystems have kept the planet cooler by absorbing billions of tons of carbon, especially during the past 60 years. Now, why is that important? Well, because of what is called the sink, S-I-N-K. A sink is a land-based carbon absorption, like a sponge. And this carbon storage capacity has kept about 190 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere just in the last 60 years. Now, this was reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And so the more green we are, the less of the carbon goes into the atmosphere. Now, go back to the 1920s, because it started in the early 20s with monoculture. In other words, where a farmer used to plant 100 different varieties of nuts and seeds and vegetables and fruits and have orchards. And then they were told, why do all that, farmer? We'll give you $3 for a bushel of wheat. And you've got 100 acres here and your neighbor has 100. So you work together. And every year you just have to get out and plant your spring wheat, and late summer, August, we'll harvest it, and we'll buy it all, and we'll give you a guaranteed price. That was just too much of a temptation for most farmers. And they started initially to see the enormous benefit. They could then put their time and energy to other things that interested them. But in time, they couldn't stop the cost of their machinery, the harvesting. And then they started to see something it hadn't seen before, enormous amounts of pests, because pests adapted to their single monocrop. You rarely get that with multiple crops. And first thing I teach as a certified organic farmer is I teach always plant companion crops, rotate them. So every year, on the outside, you have your garlic bulbs and then your shallots, and then you have your nasturtiums and pansies and all these other natural insecticides. Then you put your more sensitive leaf lettuce in the center, and then you spray it with garlic with cayenne pepper in it, and you don't lose anything. I can't remember the last time that I even lost a single head of anything to insects. But when you're just growing one single crop, first, you're destroying the nitrogen, because one of the things you do, if you know about soil conservation, is in the fall, after you've harvested your vegetables, you grow a crop like alfalfa or clover or barley. And as that turns green and it grows throughout the winter, it anchors the soil. So when the snow comes and melts in the spring, the soil doesn't get washed away with erosion, because you've anchored it. It also provides you with nitrogen. So then you turn that under, meaning you plow it under, and then whatever was growing, the soybeans or the clover, whatever, that becomes your fertilizer for the spring planting. Now, this is a time-honored tradition throughout the world. But if you never rest the soil, you end up with depleted soil. Then you end up with a great dust bowl. Then nothing grows. Then we tore down all the trees to make room for development. So we're doing our best to destroy nature. In the Amazon rainforest, one of the greatest carbon sink repositories in the world, we're clearing thousands of acres per day to grow genetically engineered soy to be fed to cattle and pigs for more meat for mainly the Southeast Asian, China. So we do this at an enormous cost. So here's what this article is saying. We have to understand that we must go green again. We must have what are called carbon savings in order to keep the universe cooler. And that means we should be planting hundreds of millions of trees. We should be planting green space everywhere. And that will help us. If not, then we're likely looking at the current carbon dioxide concentration about to 485 parts per million, well past the scientifically accepted threshold of 450 parts per million, at which the Earth's climate could drastically and irreversibly change. The current concentration is 400 parts per million. How long will it take to go from 400 parts per million to 450 and then unsustainable and an earth-changing at 485? Probably the next 5 years, the way we're doing things. And there's not a single thing in the world, not one single thing our government is doing. Not nothing. Zip. Because they'll talk about climate change, they'll talk about concern, but that's all these clowns in Washington do. These are sociopaths. These are very sick people. Don't believe anything they're doing. We have to do this ourselves, and that's that. Or there'll be a consequence. By the way, on the Keystone Pipeline, wouldn't you know we'd finally find out who was really behind this whole big push on the State Department and the Clintons and Barack Obama? It's the Koch brothers. Here's the latest from the International Forum of Globalization. Quote, a new study released today concludes that the Koch Industries and its subsidiaries stand to make as much as $100 billion in profits if the controversial Keystone XL pipeline is granted a presidential permit from President Barack Obama. The report, entitled Billionaire's Carbon Bomb, produced by the think tank International Forum on Globalization, finds that David and Charles Koch and their privately owned company, Koch Industries, own more than 2 million acres of land in northern Alberta, the source of the tar sands bitumen that would be pumped into the United States via the pipeline. It also finds that more than 1,000 reports and statements in support of Keystone XL pipeline project have been made by policy groups and think tanks that receive funding from the Koch brothers and their philanthropic foundations. So, here's how it works. Here's the takeaway message. You see a debate on MSNBC, and someone says, well, yes, you know, there should be concern about the pipeline, and if this administration really owns up to what it needs to do, it will put safety precautions there from the beginning. So we help prevent any further disasters like the Gulf spill from British Petroleum. And everyone kind of nods, that's reasonable, yes. What you don't know is the person making that statement is from a think tank, maybe a PhD, maybe with an outstanding pedigree, but the money going to the foundation and hence paying that person's salary is the Koch brothers. And I don't care if it's getting us into a war. I'm ashamed at some of the people on this very station, not Progressive Radio Network. We have a little more enlightened people. But I'm talking about some of the hacks, the corporate Democrats who promoted the invasion of Libya and Syria without thinking the consequences. And then you look at where their money comes from, the foundations. Anyone getting money from some of these foundations, in my opinion, you should look at the background of those foundations and what they support. So now we know, of the thousands of people out there who are the new talking head experts, the vast majority are merely there to do the bidding of the oligarchs. And the Koch brothers are only two of 147. And by the way, the others could, well, the others' wealth would make the Koch brothers' total combined wealth of about $30 billion seem like chump change. Pocket money. That's how wealthy some of the other people out there are. And they all are in the business of funding think tanks and experts. That's what we're not aware of. So one more reason to be against the pipeline. Finally, I'm sure that I know for a fact that many of you are concerned about what is happening here in the United States, what we've become as a nation, where we're going. And I'm sure that you watch at times or have Charlie Rose. Even 20 years ago, I was on Charlie Rose. And more often than not, I see him having the kind of the elitist on there. I rarely, if ever, see him have a true progressive on there that would challenge the previous guests or other topics they talk about. Well, I'm not alone on this. Paul Street is also on this. Recently, It was on the Charlie Rose show on PBS that they were worried about the latest financial crisis. And here's what was said, quote, that democracy doesn't work as well as we thought it did, end quote. Really, Charlie? What American democracy are you talking about? As John Bellamy Foster and Robert McChesney, who I've had on this program, noted 4 years ago, explaining why there would be no New Deal under Barack Obama, quote, the United States, despite its formerly democratic character, is firmly in the hands of a moneyed oligarchy, probably the most powerful ruling class in history, end quote. By Noam Chomsky's account, 2 years later, writing in the wake of the first elite manufactured debt ceiling crisis that, well, quite simply, it nauseated the nation and mystified the world, quote, this is from Chomsky, corporate power, by now largely financial capital, has reached the point that both political organizations, meaning Democrat and Republican, which now barely resemble traditional parties, are far to the right of the population on the major issues under debate, end quote. Evidence in support of these statements is voluminous. On issue after issue, public opinion is irrelevant. In the realm of serious politics and policy controlled by the nation's unelected dictatorship of money, that's Edward Herman's and David Patterson's phrase, take health care coverage. I did a special, whole one-hour special, which you can download from the Progressive Commentary Hour on Obamacare, why I'm against it, having nothing to do with the current arguments. Most Americans have long favored, as I do, a single-payer national health insurance plan on the Canadian model. Their preference for such substantive and seriously social democratic health reform has found no representation among the corporate and Wall Street captive lobbyists and politicians who push for big business-friendly versions of health insurance reform. The version that finally passed, the so-called Affordable Health Care Act, is a monumental, corrupt giveaway to corporate and financial plutocracy. The business right-wing Fox News and talk radio propaganda machine calls Obamacare socialism. It did not inform those it eggs into dread that the president's measure is based upon corporate-friendly prescriptions developed by right-wing Heritage Foundation in the 1990s, and that his notion of change leaves giant insurance and drug companies free to extract massive profits that drive the nation's health costs to the breaking point. The U.S. could eliminate its much-bemoaned fiscal deficit by replacing the nation's highly dysfunctional, privatized, and largely employment-based health insurance system with a universal public model similar to what exists in other industrialized nations. And with a system that could cut health care costs, I estimate that of the $3.3 trillion this year, we could bring it down to under $700 billion. And actually provide prevention, actually get the cost of what it means to be given any form of medical treatment down, give the best medical care, and challenge the corrupt practices in the pharmaceutical industry of overprescribing and overdrugging, and eliminate that. And you would save $2 to $2.5 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars per year. I've outlined this in great depth. I put this up on my website. I even offered this to Jill Stein when she was running for president, and I also offered it to Rocky Anderson and others. I sent it to Ralph Nader, and I said, what do you think of this? And they agree that the current system is corrupt, it's inefficient, it doesn't work, and lastly, the number one cause of death in the United States and injury is the current practice of medicine, not emergency medicine, but standard 88% of primary care. So the more people you actually have taking in this medicine, the more deaths and injuries. Instead of having outside independent medical scientists look at each medical procedure and see what is safe and what is effective, and no longer have the industry itself be the judge of that, we could save a lot of lives. And that should be the point, saving lives, improving the quality of life. And also, lastly, listen to how the great Kansas populist orator, Mary Ellen Lease, put things to an angry crowd just before Occupy Wall Street, launches remarkable but short-lived police state dismantled encampment lower Manhattan. Quote, Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. Our laws are the output of a system which clothes rascals in robes and honesty in rags. There are 30 men in the United States whose aggregate wealth is over $1.5 billion, and there's over 500,000 looking for work. The people are at bay. Let the bloodhounds of money who have dogged us thus far beware. That was in 1890. But she's not alone. Another sterling populist speaker of the time spoke in similar manner about the hauntingly Occupy foreshadowing terms, adding a critique of the two dominant parties, Democrat and Republican, shared subservience to the moneyed power. Ignatius Donnelly noted that the People's Party National Convention, July 4th, 1892, in terms that seem hauntingly familiar to our current New Gilded Age, quote, we meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized. The newspapers are largely subsidized or muzzled. Public opinion silenced. Businesses prostrated. Homes covered with mortgages. Labor impoverished and land concentrating in the hands of capitalists. The urban workmen are denied the right to organize for self-protection. Imported pauperized labor beats down their wages. A hireling standing army, unrecognized by our laws, is established to shoot them down. The fruits of the toil of millions are badly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few, unprecedented in the history of mankind. And the possessors of these, in turn, despite the republic and endangered liberty, we have witnessed for more than a quarter of a century the struggles of the two great political parties for power and plunder. While grievous wrongs have been inflicted upon the suffering people, we charge that the controlling influences dominating both these parties have permitted the existing dreadful conditions to develop without serious effort to prevent or restrain them. They propose to sacrifice our homes, lives, and children on the altar of mammon, to destroy the multitude in order to secure corporate funds for the millionaires. End quote. So, from the 1880s and 90s, we had populist sentiment that would virtually be in alignment with what we're manifesting today. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a brief break, come back with our guest who is standing by. We're going to take a different look of what is happening in the Middle East. My guest is Professor Paul Piller. He is a senior fellow at the Century for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution and in the Foreign Service Department at Georgetown University. He served as an intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia in the CIA during his 28-year career with the agency and was the deputy chief at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. He was the national intelligence officer for the Middle East between 2000 and 2005, and he is highly critical of the cherry-picking of intelligence and the politicalization of intelligence by the Bush administration in the lead-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. So we'll go to him in a moment, and please stay with us.
Loving you forever is a
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Again, we would like to, all of the staff and the management, the producers and the host on our sister station, WBAI, where you're listening right now, would like to thank the enormous generosity and the incredibly positive support that this station has seen in the past 7 days, where we were averaging abysmal. Now, under $10,000 a day, we have been exceeding $30,000 a day and sometimes even higher. And that means that we were able to pay our transmitter bill, some of our back rent, our current rent, our salaries, and more than 2,000 people's premiums have now been sent out. So we still have one more week to go. Please continue to support the station. We're all working together to do what we can. Then we can get back to hopefully some positive changes and some outstanding broadcasting that you want to hear 24/7. Let's now go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Piller.
Hello, Gary. Good to be with you.
With your extremely deep background in intelligence and the Middle East in particular, a lot of us are concerned when we hear only one side of an argument. And the media has only given us one side, that virtually all the problems in Syria are based upon the Syrian government, including the chemical weapons. Now, we don't know if and when the government has released chemical weapons, but we're not even looking at the possibility that the Syrian rebels, supported by the U.S., Israel, and the Saudi regime, have also the access to and the means of using these weapons. And credible reports from independent observers have suggested that's also the case. We're also concerned that we say we're fighting a war against Al-Qaeda and terrorists, and yet a new report just out today shows that our war on terrorism is actually breeding a whole new vanguard of terrorists, because for every family that we kill someone, and especially an innocent civilian, there's as many as 44 people in an extended family. And then you've just got a lot of other people who are now willing to avenge them. And yet we don't talk about this. We don't challenge the administration on its culpability. We don't even challenge the president on by what legal, international legal authority does he have the right to use these drones. And even there, even Amnesty International today, they can't tell us how many of the drone attacks are legal and how many are illegal. And no one can tell us by what measure do you determine who you're going to kill, and what do you do when you kill 7 innocent civilians for every terrorist. These are the issues that we're not addressing. I'd like for you to begin by giving us your insights into this. Would you please?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, Gary, although I commune a lot with the people who do focus on national security law. I'm an old counter-terrorist hand, and I tend to focus more on issues of what works and what doesn't from the standpoint of what ought to be our shared objectives with regard to saving lives and property. And I think it's quite appropriate to view the issue of the drone strikes in that way, not to dismiss the legal question, which is important, but I think even if we just take as our starting point that our objective is to have less rather than more terrorism and save more lives and property than we otherwise would, then there are the important questions to ask about just how effective this tool is. I don't think it can be denied that there is an immediate kinetic effectiveness with regard to taking bad guys out of commission. The larger question, of course, is what are the side effects, the collateral damage, in the sense of not only immediate deaths of people who may be innocent and not terrorists at all, but the second and third order effects that come from the resentment and the hatred that are inspired by the use of armed force, and which is what this is, by the United States. I think something like the visit about to begin of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan will have the beneficial effect of raising some of these issues to more prominence than they might otherwise have. We should note that the position of the Pakistani government is something that is a bit vague as well, in that this is a regime not just under Mr. Sharif, but also his predecessors, that probably has protested publicly more about the drone strikes than what they may have let on in private to U.S. officials. But anyway, something like this visit is an occasion for raising these issues.
I appreciate that. What happens when we have the Saudi Arabia Prince Bandar, who is the now head of intelligence? He's the chief of intelligence for Saudi Arabia. And he is determined to see a pro-U.S.-Israel-Saudi government in place. And the Saudis have a large vested interest in seeing an oil pipeline from Qatar through Syria. So what is your assessment of where the conflict is headed? Isn't the U.S. still determined to have Assad ousted?
The Syrian civil war is the prototypical example of a problem that, number one, has no good solutions, and number two, doesn't present a clear-cut set of choices with regard to who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. You alluded to this somewhat in your comments before the break, and I think this is something that our own leaders were wrestling with in a recent meeting just within the past couple of days in London. There are a couple of problems here. One is the fact that the opposition is very divided and as such is rather ineffective with regard to prosecuting a war against the regime. There is the further fact that some of the most effective militarily members of the opposition are the most extreme groups, ones that come within the Al-Qaeda orbit, and that we would describe as radical Sunni extremists or even terrorists. There certainly has been a lot of behavior on the opposition as well as the government side that I think most of us will consider reprehensible, and part of which would fit under the category of war crimes. And finally, with regard to the diplomacy and some of these discussions that were taking place just in the last few days, it appears that the opposition is the side that is balking, even more so than the government, at trying to settle this conflict through negotiation. Basically, we've had the what is supposedly the principal opposition umbrella group, the so-called National Coalition, objecting so far to sitting down at a peace conference table if the Assad government is represented. Well, that's a rather significant barrier, given that clearly the Assad government wouldn't have much incentive to sit down if a precondition for negotiations is that they're not even there. So it's hard to see any particular horse that is worth backing in this particular race from the standpoint either of effectiveness or of representing the sorts of values and conduct that we would like to associate ourselves with.
I have just one final question I think is essential to the larger issue we're addressing, Syria. And that is, we've been told that we must spend now what amounts to on and off the books total accumulative expenditures from the military-industrial intelligence complex, approximately $1.5 trillion. And yet, where we do not question that, either on the Democrat or Republican side of the aisle, in the House or the Senate or the White House, we're eviscerating social programs, lunch programs, and food stamp programs, and other programs essential to Americans' quality of life. And yet we know that it's not making us safer. We don't need to spend $1.5 trillion to be safe. In fact, tomorrow I have a commentary on how large our military is, how many ships, planes, bombs, boots on the ground, and all that we have. There's no threat we have, no viable threat in the world, and any reasonable person that looks at the evidence knows that. But you've been in the intelligence business. You were part of these risk assessment experts. So when you look at Iraq, it represented no threat to the United States, our security. Afghanistan represented no threat to the United States, our security. Libya represented none, and Syria represents none. So why in the hell are we engaging in these countries, including the corporate left, including the talking heads on MSNBC, and putting ourselves there without any thought of the consequences to the environment in these areas with depleted uranium, the infrastructure destruction, the people's quality of life forever changed, and also how many dead and injured, which is now astronomical if you take that as a total. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, you raise a whole set of legitimate issues. I think what I would most focus on, Gary, just given my background and the things I think about, is, again, the question of effectiveness. It is certainly an important and legitimate question to look at the overall threats that the United States does or does not face out in the world and reach conclusions about what level of military spending or strength we really need. And I would agree with those who would say, as you clearly do, that we're spending much more than we need. But beyond that, one looks at a problem like Syria or like Libya, and you have to ask yourself, regardless of how much or how little we spend, how effective can we be in relying heavily on military force as we have in situations like Libya or like Iraq? And the answer has to be we've been not very effective at all, no matter how much we spent. And I think those two countries I just mentioned, Iraq, which has been recently sliding back into a higher level of civil warfare and with, you know, car bombs going off in the streets of Baghdad just about every day, and Libya, where whatever you may have thought about Muammar Gaddafi, the situation we have now is a far more chaotic, more dangerous one than we had before. And the whole brouhaha politically in this country over the incident last year at Benghazi, in which Ambassador Stevens and three others were killed, really should have led us to think more, not so much about the politics of what kind of talking points, you know, Susan Rice had and all the nonsense we heard at the time, but rather what did that say about the wisdom of the Libyan intervention in the first place. And I think what it says to me is that particular intervention, whatever we may have thought about Gaddafi, was a mistake, and it was a demonstration of how even the low casualty, high tech use of military force, such as we employed there, ultimately brings about a result that is not necessarily an improvement at all.
Well, I appreciate your insights, and you've done a lot on this subject, and thank you for being a responsible voice out there who has the background to give us some truth on this matter. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary. Good to talk with you.
Bye. Dr. Paul Piller, and by the way, Dr. Piller received his degrees and taught from Dartmouth, Oxford University, and his PhD from Princeton University. I'm Gary Knoll. For the last segment of our program, it may run just a few minutes over. I'm warning our supportive stations out there. It's important. You're going to hear about GMOs and how they're really dealt with, in this case by Fox News. People who tried to tell the truth about GMOs and their danger and what kind of buzzsaw they ran into. Just a quick mention, however, for those of you who want or need some nutrition counseling, health counseling, I can't personally do it because I'm only working with very seriously ill people, and I will be back in town next week. But I have hired good quality people that will see you for free, no strings attached. Just call them. Danny on Saturday, he's phenomenal. Larry in the evening, he's great. Sandy on Sunday afternoon, terrific. Every day we have different people, and they're there to help you with whatever you'd like helped and guide you. So give a call, 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000. Now, how GMOs are really dealt with.
...told us was that we were just the people to be the investigators.
Do any stories you want.
ask tough questions and get answers. So we thought, this is great. This is a dream job. Fantastic. The very first thing they had us do was not to research stories, but to shoot this promo, which was The Investigators.
Uncovering the truth and getting results. Protecting you.
And they had a film crew and a smoke machine, and we were silhouetted.
Investigative report, Steve.
One of the first stories that Jane came up with was the revelation that most of the milk in the state of Florida and throughout much of the country was adulterated with the effects of bovine growth hormone, the artificial hormone that farmers were injecting into their cows so that they would produce more milk.
With Monsanto, I didn't realize how effectively a corporation could work to get something on the marketplace. The levels of coordination they had to have. They had to get university professors into the fold. They had to get experts into the fold. They had to get reporters into the fold. They had to get the public into the fold. And of course, the FDA, let's not leave them out. They had to get the federal regulators convinced that this was a fine and safe product to get it onto the marketplace. And they did that. They did that very, very well.
It's a great time to be a high-producing cow. Posilac One Step, Bovine Somatotropin by Monsanto.
The federal government basically rubber-stamped it before they put it on the marketplace. The longest test they did for human toxicity was 90 days on 30 rats.
Posilac is the single most tested new product in history and is now available to you specifically so you can increase your profit potential.
And then either Monsanto misreported the results to the FDA, or the FDA didn't bother to look in depth at Monsanto's own studies.
The scientists within Health Canada looked very carefully at bovine growth hormone and came to very different conclusions than the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. did.
Monsanto's engineered growth hormone did not comply with safety requirements. It could be absorbed by the body and therefore did have implications for human health. Mysteriously, that conclusion was deleted from the final published version of their report.
They knew there were problems. They saw serious potential human health problems, and they stood up in Canada and said, we're not going to approve this because we don't believe it's safe.
We have been pressured and coerced to pass drugs of questionable safety, including the RBST. I personally was very concerned that there's a very serious problem of secrecy, conspiracy, and things of that nature, and something needs to be done.
The FDA was then on the hot seat. They had to come up with an answer. They didn't come up with a good one. And they never took the opportunity then. I mean, what would they do? Pull it off the market and say, we need to now do the job that we didn't do the first time? They didn't do that.
We wrote the story. We had it ready a week beforehand. They bought ads.
Farmers in the milk industry say it's safe, but studies suggest a link to cancer. Don't miss this special report from the investigators.
That Friday night before the Monday this series was to begin, the fax machine spit out a letter from this very high-priced lawyer in New York that Monsanto had hired. It contained a lot of things that were just off the wall false, just demonstrably false. But if you didn't know the story and you didn't know how we had gone about producing it, it would have scared you as a broadcaster, as a manager.
And they decided that they would pull the story and they would just check it one more time.
But the bottom line was that there was no factual errors in that story. Both sides had been heard from. Both sides had had an opportunity to speak.
1 week later, Monsanto sent the second letter. And this was even more strongly worded. And it said there will be dire consequences for Fox News if the story airs in Florida. And this time they freaked. They were afraid of being sued, and they were also afraid of losing advertising dollars at all of the stations owned by Rupert Murdoch. And he owned more television stations than any other group in America. That's 22 television stations. That's a lot of advertising dollars for Roundup, Aspartame, NutraSweet, and other products.
So we got into a battle, and the first deal was the new general manager.
And his name's Dave, and Dave is a salesman, and, you know, he'd pump your hand. How you doing? How you doing?
Called us upstairs to his office, and he said, what would you say if I killed this piece? What if it never ran? And we said, well, you know, we wouldn't be very happy about that. And he said, well, I could kill it, you know. And we said, yes, of course, you're the manager. You could kill it. It would never air. And he's hemming and he's hawing and he's back and he's forth. And we couldn't figure out, what is this all about? And finally he blurted out, look, would you tell anybody? You know, I said, I'm not going to lie for you. About a week later, calls us back to the office and says, okay, we'd like you to make these changes. In fact, you will make these changes. We said, well, look, let us show you the research that we have that shows that this information you want us to broadcast isn't true. To which he replies, I don't care about that. I said, pardon me? And he said, well, that's what I have lawyers for. Just write it the way the lawyers want it written. I said, you know, this is news. This is important. This is stuff people need to know. And I'll never forget, he didn't pause a beat, and he said, we just paid $3 billion for these television stations. We'll tell you what the news is. The news is what we say it is. I said, I'm not doing that. And he said, well, he said, if you refuse to present the story the way we think it should be presented, you'll be fired for insubordination. I said, I will go to the Federal Communications Commission and I will report that I was fired from my job by you, the licensee of these public airwaves, because I refused to lie to people on the air. And it's thank you very much. You'll hear from us right away. Well, 24 hours came and went, and we didn't hear a thing. And about a week later, he calls us back, and now we've changed strategies. How about if we pay you some money and you just go away? And I said, how much money? Because, you know, when somebody offers to bribe you like that, I always want to know if it might be worth it.
He was going to offer us the rest of our year's salary if we agreed not to talk about what Monsanto had done, to not talk about the Fox corporate response in suppressing the story, and to not talk about the story, not talk about BGH again, anywhere, not take the story to another news organization. Zip up.
I said, you mean if I want to go to my daughter's PTA meetings and explain what's in the school milk at the school lunch program? I can't. No, you can never speak about this anywhere.
And Steve says, okay, write it up. And I'm like, write it up? What are you talking about? Write it up. And I didn't say anything. And Dave, he wrote it up. And he FedExed it to us a couple of days later. And he said, are you going to sign? And we said, nah, Dave, we're not going to sign that. And he said, we'll send it back, okay? I said, no, Dave, we're not going to send that back.
It was, okay, we can't buy you out. We can't shut you up. Let's get the story on the air in a way that we can all agree it will go on the air. And we started rewriting and editing with their lawyers.
Well, during this 8-month re-review process, I say jokingly, they did things like, for example, they wanted to take out the word cancer. You don't have to identify what the potential problem is, but just say human health implications. Any criticism of Monsanto or its product, they either removed it or minimized it. And it was very, very clear, I would say, almost every edit they made to the piece, that was the aim.
And we changed this and this and this, and then that wasn't good enough. Okay, now change this and this and this. Now change this and this. Version after version after version. 83 times.
83 times is unheard of. It doesn't happen. You shouldn't have to rewrite something 83 times. Obviously, they didn't want to put the thing on the air, and they were trying to drive us crazy and get us to quit or wait until the first window in our contract so that they could fire us.
They, in effect, announced that they were going to fire us for no cause. Well, this was a little much.
And Steve wrote a letter to the lawyer in Atlanta, whose name is Carolyn Forrest, the Fox corporate lawyer.
And I said, you know, this isn't about being fired for no cause. You're firing us because we refused to put on the air something that we knew and demonstrated to be false and misleading. That's what this is about. And because we put up a fight, because we stood up to this big corporation, and we stood up to your editors, and we stood up to your lawyers, and we said to you, look, there ought to be a principle higher than just making money.
And she wrote a letter back and said, you're right. That's exactly what it was. You stood up to us on this story, and that's why we're letting you go.
Jane sued Fox under Florida's whistleblower statute, which protects those who try to prevent others from breaking the law. But her appeal court judges found that falsifying news isn't actually against the law.
Florida's appellate court has ruled in favor of Fox 13. You may recall that Jane Akre, a former reporter here, sued Fox 13 in a whistleblower lawsuit, claiming she was fired for refusing to distort her report. The appeals court today threw that case up, saying Ms. Akre had no whistleblower claim against the station based on news distortion. Fox 13 Vice President and General Manager Bob Linger says the station has been completely vindicated by the ruling.
And that's what you have. I'm Gary Knoll, and that shows you what we're up against in our war on with the truth, trying to get GMOs labeled as they should be. Any food grown should be labeled if it's GMO food. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
What a beautiful time.